Hall of Blue Illumination, the podcast dedicated to M.A.R. Barker's legendary world of Tecumel.
Welcome to the Hall of Blue Illumination, episode 7. Today we're going to continue talking about the 1975 game Empire of the Petal Throne. Last week, or last episode, I suppose, I talked about my biases and approach to the game. And this time, we're going to get Victor's experiences with the game to provide us a completely different point of view than mine. And I'm sure James will have a different point of view as well. So that being said, Victor, what would you like to tell us about your experiences with the game Empire of the Petal Throne?
Oh, my. Well, let's see here. I think one of the things that I discovered when I started running my own Empire of the Petal Throne campaign, my own Tecumel campaign, is that the Empire of the Petal Throne rules are very tightly packed. Okay? And what I mean by that is there's a heck of a lot of information there that Professor Barker presented in a way to make the world accessible to people. But what it also did was it meant that there are a bunch of different things that are in there that he sort of seemingly casually mentions, and then it's up to you to notice that it's there. For example, when we were talking in the last episode about the skill system, there's a skill system in there, and it's something that is put forth there for the referee to use, except that I would suspect that an awful lot of people would have ghosted right by it, just simply because it's mentioned for a few of the skills in the original skills section, section 420, and then it references a completely different chart. Okay? The spell success chart.
Yeah, see, I didn't even know about that. The rules are, in fact, so dense that I have glazed over on my eyes several times in attempting to absorb them, and that using skills in the spell success chart was like a total revelation for me.
Yeah, and it's one of those things that I think, if referees were going to use something like this, they would want to have that more explicitly spelled out. I mean, I would think that, referees could easily pull out that skill success chart and go from there, and then add various different modifiers, because it's quite clear that there are modifiers that you can add. In the case of spells, it has to do with your psychic ability. But clearly for some other skills, other characteristics may apply, right? And then there's like degrees of success, not just degrees of success, but degrees of difficulty and easiness, that aren't really factored in here at all. And I mean, I think it's kind of amazing because I didn't really notice it until I started running my own game, and I was like, wait a second, this is a fairly straightforward skill system in a game that's produced in 1975.
Yeah, that is pretty amazing to me.
Yeah. Now, some people say, well, but it's not very well realized. It's like, okay, sure. I'm happy to go along with that. But once you know it's there, it becomes the basis for doing a whole bunch of different things. Okay? And then there's other things that don't become evident right away, but are things that you need to resolve. One of the things that is genuinely an issue in the original EPT rules is that simultaneously in section 630, the number of experience points that you need to go up goes up and up and up, just like in D&D. And by the way, foreshadowing of third edition D&D, it is almost a completely unified experience point progression table. There's only some slight modifications for, I think it's magic users. At higher levels, and that's it. But, okay, so you need more and more experience points to go up levels. But in Section 620, Professor Barker says, you know, as you go up in levels, you get fewer and fewer experience points effectively. You know, it's basically you only get a percentage of the experience points that, you know, you earn. So those numbers don't not only go up, but you're counting fewer of the ones you actually gain. So the amount to go up levels is even worse. Okay. And the thing about it is that I think, you know, if I had a piece of advice, it is the Section 620 should only apply if characters of the levels cited are facing opponents that are weaker than themselves.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, in the sense of, you know, levels 1 to 3, you get 100% of experience points, but from levels 4 to 5, you're only supposed to get 50 experience points.
No, I understand how that works. We've encountered it in the Socotus campaign that I'm running, because the characters are all like 4th and 5th level, so they're in that range where they get half of their XP taken away, any earned XP, they only get half of what it is. But I've just been playing that straight. I'm curious, what is your rationale about if you're facing opponents that are of equal or higher difficulty to your own level? What are your thoughts on that? Why?
Well, it's partly suggested by the reasoning that is there in Section 620, okay, which is to say, since it is proportionally more difficult for powerful characters to deserve experience points than for more vulnerable, lower-level characters. Mm. And so the suggestion there is that higher level characters are simply less vulnerable. But if they're facing something that is of equal or greater, power in terms of hit dice or level, then yeah. I mean, then it seems to me as though you can take that into account. It should also be noted that in Seal of the Imperium, I forget which of the two columns Professor Barker wrote for the dragon, he mentions this as an issue that is simply unresolved. And in fact, what's interesting about it is that the time they wrote that, you can see him already beginning to try to uncouple levels from social status. Mm. Because that was something that that is implied by the rules without being necessarily explicitly there. You know, I think this was just simply an issue for Professor Barker of how the game itself was progressing, that somebody could be a high level fighting man or priest or magic user, but not be actually a Dritlan or a Semel, or one of the other high-ranking social positions that went along with that. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's some stuff here where, yeah, you know, in a sense, what we have here in Section 630 is this conflation between what is your ability, you know, what is your character's ability, how able are they to be whatever they are, and their social standing, right? You know, just because somebody is ninth level does not necessarily make them a Mringu Koi, you know, a great noble. But it also suggests something else, which is something that I think a lot of people miss, and that is that in a very real way, Tekemel's, the way that Tekemel is presented here in Empire of the Petal Throne, the levels are really from 1 to 10. And by the time you reach 10th level, there's a supposition that you're going to go on to do Tekemel's version of the campaign game. Mm-hmm. You know, you're going to become a mighty general, conducting grand strategy and engaging in warfare between empires, or you're going to be a high priest and you will be engaging in the development of the doctrine of your god and, you know, the propagation of the faith. And if you're a magic user, you're going to be doing, you know, various operations that might have to do with the planes beyond, who knows, you know. And in all these cases, if you're imperial governor, you also are going to have to manage your fief and figure out what else is going to go on and deal with the political factions that are there and try to make some money on the side and who knows. So, and I think that to today's mind, with people being used to 20th and 30th level characters, the idea that you go from 1 to 10 and that's it is a little quick.
Some newer games have addressed that. I think Dungeon Crawl Classics was pretty smart to say levels are 1 to 10. Beyond that, you're pretty much a demigod or on your own. So
yeah,
This is the game that's being presented. And it's interesting to find that in 1975 as well. It makes me think that perhaps they were taking a page out of this playbook or something like it.
I think so. I mean, I think part of it is that the campaign game, as was originally presented in D&D, is something that got sort of glossed over as people were not used to the idea of engaging in campaigns of the sort of grand strategic level that people in the Twin Cities or in Lake Geneva were used to. You know, I mean, that's what Gary and Dave did. You know, similarly, Professor Barker did, you know, similar sorts of things because he knew both of them and was playing board games and miniatures games with many of the same people.
I think in any time period, finding that level of stability in a role-playing group is relatively uncommon.
I think one of the reasons why that was for not just Tecumel, but for gaming at the time, was simply that it was a relatively small, somewhat insular group of people who knew one another and knew one another well enough to plan that they were going to be engaging in many different games at once. And so there was a social group aspect to it, of where they all knew one another and basically got along. And yes, that's not as, it's not something you can easily depend upon today.
Yeah. I think The Purdue Fantasy Club was maybe the second generation of that kind of phenomenon. As far as I know, it started in the late 70s. I didn't get involved till 83, which in a way was kind of, I don't know, the first bloom of it had faded by then. But it was a group of people in the Midwest influenced by the original games and the original people, you know, going to Gen Con every year. But it had that same kind of continuity where you could have the campaign game going on, but also different groups in the same world with lower level characters doing other things. And all these groups were somehow related. It's kind of the mythical snipe nowadays. I would like to participate in something like that, but maybe that's more difficult than, I don't know, maybe it isn't difficult. It's just something that I'm looking on nostalgically, perhaps, as being rather amazing. Something that would happen for a short period of time that brought a lot of people together on the same imaginative page.
Well, I'm not so sure it's so difficult, and maybe that's simply because I spent about 12 years as a paid community organizer. Here in Madison, Wisconsin, we now have Madison Traditional Gaming, which I started in 2009, so we're coming up on 8 years now, 7.5 years. And we now regularly get 50 people on a Tuesday night playing in 8 different role-playing campaigns. And we have expanded to some Saturdays, including a monthly session at a local library and a biweekly session at another game store. We just started that.
That's great. That's,
yeah. And the secret that we found to this is that you need to mix things up a little bit. You need to make sure that people have choices in terms of what games that they're going to play. And you change it up on a regular basis so that nobody is stuck having to play in the same thing if they don't want to. You know, you basically, but three times a year, we basically say, okay, we're going to do something different now. And in the case of like a university club, well, you know, quite frankly, an awful lot of things would have gone on for the course of the academic year and then would have probably been put on hiatus over the summer, or something different was done in yeah. the summertime, you know. But I think one of the ways in which D&D ended up shifting things around was that you had originally D&D was an outgrowth of this kind of club format where you had lots of people, but not all of them playing at the same time. But then as D&D spread, and as I think James and Scott, as you both encountered it, well, wait a second, I'm not so sure about this, but as you may have encountered it, you had this game that was produced, you know, basic D&D. And if you look at TSR's ads from the 1980s, you will see these very clean-cut, freshly scrubbed teenagers sitting around a dining room table playing D&D with one another. A wholly unrealistic depiction, I should add.
That was abhorrent to me at that time.
Yeah. Oh, sure. But what they were doing was they were trying to present sort of this ideal. Hey, kids, you know. Here, I've got a box. We have some dice. Let's play a game. And what this did, though, was it meant that people ended up gaming with their closest friends, okay, that if they didn't have a club to belong to. And so their only sense of how to play the game was very much within the closed space of what they had with the people that they, you know, that they knew, you know, the few friends that were actually playing the game with them. And so the idea that, you know, well, wait a second, we're playing a game here, and one table over, there's somebody playing a different game. The only encounter that they would have ever had with that would have been at, like, a convention, if they went to a convention, if they knew there were conventions. So my sense on this is that I think as gamers, we could all do a better job in terms of finding more public venues to do our gaming in and to advertise it out to other people and to, you know, help bring people together for regular sessions. Now, I'm evangelical about this. I'll be very honest. I'm very, you know, I believe that there's lots of room for us to have gaming clubs, and we should all explore that. But I also think that something like Techamel benefits from this kind of thing, because Techamel is a game which I've learned over time benefits from having a lot of time to grow, to develop, that it is not just the experience of the characters themselves, but the characters in the larger context of this very complex and vast social world, and that world has lots of things going on in it besides the characters. And the only way that you really get at that is that if you actually have enough time to develop it.
Yeah, that's I am bowing down to the wisdom of the ages.
You know, actually, I don't know if I would have, you know, known that as fully. I mean, I played with Professor Barker for like 25 years. Admittedly, not all of that time. There were times when I took breaks in there, but we all did from time to time. But during that time, I was just used to the fact that things were going to develop over time. You know, my characters were from, you know, different time spans of the campaign. And it was only after James had been running his Socatus campaign for over a year that in our discussions of all of this, we began to realize, oh, wait a second, you know, this isn't just like D&D where you can run some adventures and have some fun. This is a game that wants time. Mm-hmm. It needs time to grow.
And I wonder, and again, maybe you have some insight into this, why it is that that happens. Because, and I don't want to belittle Empire of the Pale Throne by any stretch of the imagination, but in a certain sense, it is really just a fantasy role-playing game of its era with a background, which is a setting that is presented, compared to later versions of it anyway, somewhat thinly, I guess. You know, because there's a lot of the detail that we get later on isn't there. But yet, despite that relative, relatively limited amount of material that you're presented, you're absolutely correct. It really, it does feel like it wants that kind of approach to it, that it really comes into its own and starts to shine in that sort of environment. But why is that? I mean, what do you think? I mean, you have a lot more experience with playing these things. Like, what do you think it is about it that makes it so, you know, really come into its own in that kind of a situation?
The answer to that, I think, is pretty straightforward. And that is that characters advance not only in terms of whatever personal ability they have, but also as having certain kinds of social rank. And that social rank only comes about from the interaction that they have with the rest of the world. And that this sets Tecumel apart in some ways from other fantasy settings, particularly for D&D, where, well, sure, you know, it's possible to advance, you know, if you really wanted to, you know, become high ranking as a Red Wizard of Thay or, you know, or the like, you can do that. But very few other worlds actually, other settings actually require this kind of engagement. Whereas in Tecumel, it's part and parcel of why the characters are there. You have arrived in the great and glorious empire, the heirs of the Engsmanyali priest kings and queens, the ultimate succession of civilization as we know it, right? And so therefore, you're now supposed to make something of yourself. I mean, in a very real way, I mean, this is a Bildungsroman, you know, this is a... This is how do you come of age and become something, right?
Yeah. I was going to say, that's a very good point. I mean, the Fresh Off the Boat campaign, for example, about which we've spoken before, does contain within it the seeds of a sort of arc, you know, a development. Like your character arrives as a nobody and you are supposed to make yourself something through the course of the campaign. And it's very explicitly the case that you do that by the interaction with finding patrons and so forth within, you immerse yourself in the society. Whereas say D&D, and again, I don't mean this as any kind of a slight against D&D, there is sort of a sense it's a more individualistic sort of goal. It's a sort of, well, you know, you're a warrior of some sort or sorcerer. You go off, you do things, you acquire power, and you do whatever you want. It doesn't really require anyone else because you can get what you need elsewhere. You go into the wilderness or in a dungeon or whatever. But in Tecumel and Empire of the Pale Throne, you need help to do that.
Here's an observation that I think is relevant, and that is with D&D, it seems like the adventure comes first and the world comes after. And with Empire of the Pale Throne, Tecumel came first and the adventure came second. So this involvement of having a character involved in something that is a large personal quest interrelated with a society is, that makes perfect sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm sort of rolling that around and thinking about it, I think there is something to that. The Tecumel is always bigger than whatever adventure the characters are on. And that's something that I very rarely get in playing in other settings. I'm not saying it doesn't happen. I recently, for example, ended up playing a game at one of our monthly Saturday sessions, I should say, of Madison Traditional Gaming. I played a game set in the Eclipse Phase setting, which has this gloriously overblown set of mechanics to run it. I must admit, the referee kept telling us that he had simplified everything for us, and I was thinking, wow, this is simplified. Oh, okay, great. Wonderful.
To bring your slide rule.
It wasn't quite that bad, but there was a certain amount of okay. It's a new system, right? I can deal with that. I like learning new systems, but the Eclipse Phase setting itself was huge. It was sprawling. It's this massive near future, very dark science fiction setting. And I enjoyed it immensely. I was sitting going, like, wow, this is really cool. I know there's more going on in this world than my character is ever going to experience. This is great. And I think Tecumel is in some ways the same way. You know, that there's just no way that any one character is going to be able to experience all the different things that are possible.
That's true. And I think my experience refereeing it is that it's kind of important to convey that in various ways. It's part of what makes the setting what it is this notion that in both directions, both into the past and into the future, as well as the present, there's so much going on that you can only begin to scratch the surface of it. That you're never, your characters, no matter what they do, no matter how important they become, how immersed they become in the various politics and machinations and great events that are going on, there's still lots more happening. And that to me is a big part of what makes Tecumel Tecumel.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's clear from the presentation in Empire of the Petal Throne that Professor Barker knew this, that he knew that you were going to have lots of stuff going on and that it was really up to the referee to figure out how to engage in this larger collective exploration of the world. I mean, I'm looking at, in Empire of the Petal Throne, there's all these books that...
Yeah, those are amazing.
Yeah, that the characters can find. And I'm just looking at one of them here, okay? Or I should say I'm not looking at the actual book. I'm looking at the listing.
Yeah, yeah. What's the page?
I just happened to be looking.
You just happen to have a copy of the book
just
of Black
Mold.
What page are you on?
Right there. Page 84.
And I wish you had a copy of a book or a facsimile of it. What a great...
We have but one page.
We have, yes.
Yes, we have one page.
I haven't seen the original. I would like to do that.
Yeah. So let's see here. So the book that I'm looking at here is Chaniseal Hihaya, I should say. Chaniseal Hihaya. No, I'm sorry, I'm still getting that wrong. I'm looking at this. Hihaya, right. Chaniseal Hihaya. Powerful Maps of Glory. Okay. This is a book of treasure maps in modern Soliani. I mean, mind you, this sort of question gets asked, who drew these, right? Okay, but we won't go there. Maybe it was Waba.
We should go there. That needs to be answered.
That needs to be answered.
Well, in the Sokata's campaign, one of the characters has a copy of that book. He was given as a wedding gift.
There you go. Wonderful. Yes. These are usable by anyone of experience level 3 or higher. The referee will determine the number of maps by rolling a 6-sided die. He then uses the list of ancient cities in section 1200 or some other random method to determine the location of the treasures. At the referee's discretion, they may lie hidden in the underworld or be concealed somewhere above ground. I mean, this is a very straightforward way of saying you should go make some stuff up.
Yeah. How would you, in-game, not enforce or justify necessarily, but massage the narrative such that characters less than level 3 couldn't use the book? Not introduce it? Or, I mean, what...
Oh, no.
How would you do that?
Oh, that one's totally easy. The way that I would go about doing that would be to say, You know, your familiarity with Sulyani as a language is insufficient. That it is written, these maps are done in a abstruse and abbreviated format that only someone who has been here long enough could actually understand.
But what if your game's full of native speakers?
If it's native speakers?
Yeah, that's where I was coming from.
Oh, I see. Oh, something like that. Well, then, under those circumstances, part of it would be simply a matter of I would enforce that even more so. I would say this is the equivalent of a rutter. The approach to it is a periplus. I mean, again, I think we're so used to the
idea. Okay, you got me. Rutter and periplus. Okay, if there is an award to be awarded, you get it. Please explicate these arcane terms to me.
Oh my goodness.
You don't use these words in your daily life, Scott?
I'm
quite disappointed.
Gee whiz. It's not every day I learn some good ones. Pray continue, sir.
I should warn you that Professor Barker would do this to us on a regular basis. He would just end up using offhandedly some word, and we would sit there and go, Phil, what did you just say? And he would have a reaction of like, don't you know? You know, what's wrong with you?
It's an example in the modern day of civilizational decline that the education system is such that we just don't use these terms.
That's right. We're no longer as polysyllabically perverse as we might otherwise be. a rutter is a form of a navigational narrative that dates back to the time of the era of exploration. And before there was an accurate measure of longitude, what was necessary was to have extremely detailed notes about how you got from point A to point B. And a periplus is another version of this sort of thing.
That's a Greek one.
Yeah, it dates back earlier. And I think we're so used to having very, you know, relatively speaking, very accurate maps, Mercator projection notwithstanding, that we sort of think that, well, can't people just pick up a map and use it without really realizing, particularly if you've read Man of Gold, that Sulyani don't have maps really of that sort.
That's right.
You know, character at best, of less than level 3 perhaps lacks the purse capacity to
indeed to
decode the rutter.
Yeah. And it's more a matter of just familiarity with it. Now, if somebody had taken like the navigator skill, or if they had taken the interpreter skill, that would be a point when I would say, oh, well, okay, you know, make a roll and let's see if you can understand this. Oh, you know, you were successful. Excellent. I will now tell you what is contained within this book.
Well, this is another example of the kind of thing that puzzles me about Empire of the Petal Throne that I'm glad that we're running into.
Though I suspect that some of the books that have level limitations on them, it's because of some magic aspect of them.
Yeah, those ones are more clear-cut.
Right, true. But anyway.
What's interesting about this is that those level limitations, I mean, I think this also gets at some at another aspect of this that is worth paying attention to, and that is when D&D and Empire of the Petal Throne were first produced, we didn't have 40 years of discussing, well, how do you run a game?
Mm-hmm.
You know, at this point, edging up on, dare I say, 45 years. Okay. And what that meant was there are some artifacts of a simpler form of gameplay that appear in both D&D and also in Empire of the Petal Throne. These limitations by level, for example, are part of a somewhat more simplified and abbreviated sense of how characters actually operated. Now, some people, some theorists more recently, some social science critics, have suggested that this meant that if you play D&D, original D&D, or Empire of the Petal Throne, you weren't really role-playing. And the problem with that argument is that if you talk to the people who played at the time and who've played since then, oh no, you're role-playing. It's just that the rules themselves are for a more gamed aspect of the role-playing experience. But what you did with your character and how you expressed themselves and what kind of personality they have, that was left up to you. It wasn't that it wasn't there. It was that it was left up to you as the player to take the character from the stats and make it into a real person in that sense. And so the suggestion that somehow that wasn't going on is it's a kind of scriptural misanalysis, if I might say.
That completely makes sense. And that would be my experience with the Purdue Fantasy Group long ago, which was pretty rules light, to be honest. Dan Lawrence was the guy who started it, as far as I know. You guys remember a game called Telengard, published on Avalon mm-hmm. Hill? Dan Lawrence yes. wrote Telengard.
Oh, cool. I did not know that.
He also wrote Micro Emacs, which is a famous editor in computer programming world.
I remember Telengard. I wasted a lot of time on Telengard.
So, yeah, Dan was a very interesting character with regard to gaming because he got started, I think, around 75 and started doing things at Purdue and turned a lot of people on to D&D and Empire of the Petal Throne. But this brings me back to this notion of large campaigns kind of early on in the history of the hobby. And Victor, you mentioned that they didn't have 40 to 45 years of experience on how to put things together and sustain them. And that, in part, is what fascinates me about that time period, is that there really wasn't much of a roadmap.
And no, people, not at all.
People needed to be creative in order to have a game because there simply wasn't that much material available.
Well, I remember very distinctly when I went to the Littleton Soldier Shop as a teenager. This would have been, somewhere in the late 70s. Like 77, somewhere in there, 78. And I ended up picking up a copy of Empire of the Petal Throne. And the very first thing I was told was, well, that's a really complex world. It's a really expensive game.
Yeah.
And it sort of stuck with me that this is a lot. There's a lot here, right? And if I had any advice for anybody approaching TechML, it would be if you picked up Empire of the Petal Throne as a rule set, don't think of it as D&D set on TechML, despite it, you know, whatever surface resemblance it might be. Think of it instead as TechML is this world that uses D&D as a lens through which it can be viewed, right? This or D&D-like lens to view it. But the world is so much more than just a setting for a set of rules, right? And maybe I'm not even really being as clear as I could be about this, but it's like there's so much in this book of 100 and some pages that you should sit down, read it, and make some notes before you start playing the game in terms of what pieces of it are the ones that grab your attention, you know, and you can make those part of the focus of your game. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. That's what I am doing, frankly, to, you know, yeah. this new thing. I think that's a pretty strong cadence to shift the topic. I would like to continue to talk about Empire of the Petal Throne in the next few episodes. I think there's plenty of stuff to be unpacked. But for now, let us shift our attention to our new segment. Let us pronounce the mighty Tlokiri Kaluyal.
That is quite good.
Thank you.
Yes. Tlokiri Kaluyal. Even I am stumbling over that. So, yes, you have the five gods of change. Right. And in the original Empire of the Petal Throne rules, you have the spelling for the supreme principle of evil as H-R-Y apostrophe Y with an accent over it. And this is noted in the pronunciation guide as to be rather like that of a the U umlaut, umlauted U of German. Right? And then in the Tsoyani language books, it's noted that there's two different ways to pronounce it. Hi'i and hi'i, right? One is slightly more accent, not even accent. I'm not even sure how to describe it. I'm not a linguist. I'm a sociologist. but hi'i would be the way to pronounce that one. Some people, it's simplified. You'll occasionally hear people sort of anglicize it to being
hru'u. Yeah, see, that's how I've always done it before I started hanging out with you, and now my pronunciation is more sophisticated. And my status will be elevated at frequent and involved meetings that we secretly have in an alternate dimension. Hri'i, supreme principle of evil. We need to talk about that at some point. Master of negation and non-being. Opponent of good and dispenser of calamities.
Yeah, the notation actually that we have here is the Y is pronounced as the Y of yes. Yes. A voice palatal consonant, but the Y in vowels, which is what we're talking about, we have there's a whole long section on this in page 108 about this, and it's actually worth working its way up. So yes, the supreme principle of evil, and worth noting here, I'm just going to go back to this because this is something that gets noted at the very beginning of things, is that Professor Barker makes a point of saying, now be careful about talking about good and evil. He says in section 300, is it 300? Wait, let me be clear here. Yes, that's right. 310, actually. Those serving the good gods and their cohorts and those serving their evil counterparts. Okay. And he says that, but he makes a point of saying that good and evil are not defined the way that they are here. That there's a different sense to them, to those words. And so, so I tend to prefer thinking of this as his more, as Professor Barker's later more explicit sense of it, which is as a expression of change and stability.
Yeah, that's a discussion for
we could go another on for episode. Sometime.
We've had a request over email to do an episode on the Book of Ebon Bindings, so I suspect that would be a good opening salvo for this whole notion. But let us continue through the Tlokiri Kaluyal.
Yeah, very good.
James, you want to take a crack at one?
Yeah, please do.
Oh, gee.
Do you have the text in front of you?
Yeah, but I know the names of the gods.
But do you know the
titles
as well?
No, not off the top of my head.
Well, I'll read the title, and if you say the name.
Sure. So wait, we want to move on to who, actually, who's number? Yes. Who they list as number two? Just give me his titles or her.
The
titles.
Lord of Fire.
That's what I thought. Okay.
Power of Destruction, man. And Red Ruin, Maker of Thunders.
Yes, good old Vimukla.
Friend of the Vridi.
Oh, that's listed as one of his titles?
No, but I just thought I'd throw it in there because I'm a big fan of the Vridi.
That was remarkable.
And if given the opportunity, I'm going to run a game in Fasildum.
Oh, excellent. The City of Chiming Skulls.
Yeah, hey, can I do the next one?
Sure.
Sure.
So next in the Tlokili Kaluyal is Xarul. Ah, actually, strike that. I am wrong.
You are.
Oh, no. What's wrong with that? Oh, I see.
The first syllable. Yeah, everyone does that, but I want to do it right in the show. Next, sure. In the Tlokili Kaut, the Harfrakaj Flickin' Flackin', in the Gods of Chains, Xarul.
The ancient lord of secrets, doomed prince of the Blue Room, master of magic and grammary. Now, it is revealed in the dispatches to the Imperium that Lord Xarul is imprisoned in the Blue Room, and that there's this whole myth cycle built up around him, and that's part and parcel of the greater campaign of Tekemel. You could put a campaign all around just that, and you still wouldn't get it all done. So,
well, you could put a campaign just around one of the keys and still not find it.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. Yeah. And so we're brought to the next Lord of Change, Lord Sarku. Wait, I should pronounce that better. Lord Sarku.
Mm-hmm. But it's not of mine.
Yes, you are intimately familiar with the details of Sarku.
Oh, whoa, let's be careful here.
Yeah,
intimately familiar.
I'm not into that.
Actually, yeah, exactly. That sort of thing does not make its appearance in your campaign.
Not as of yet, no.
Despite the Dlamelish influence that I and others are trying to bring.
I was making more a reference to the character whose fiancé's body is embalmed and kept in the basement.
Okay, Sarku. See, I like to roll the R. The five-headed Lord of Worms, master of the undead, guide into darkness the demon of decay.
I think that's a very Victorian, bolderized depiction of a god of immortality. How could anyone possibly think that there's anything wrong with that? I can't.
Well, we could have a lengthy discussion of that as well. I'm sure we will. I am inclined to somewhat agree with that.
Maybe that's how they get the punters in the temple door.
Well, actually, it is an aspect of Lord Sarku's theology that what he promises is a very practical form of immortality.
Indeed. Absolutely.
And he is as bound up with the cycle of life and death as Lady Avante. You know, you go up into the Kra Hills, you'll find peasants who worship Lord Sarku because it is necessary for all things to come to an end before they can be given rebirth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's not just there. I mean, I'm just simply saying there. It's very much a part of Soyani culture that there is a place for Lord Sarku. It's not just a, you know, Lord Sarku is not just a god of the undead, you know, bogeyman to frighten people. Mind you, he's good at that, but...
Yeah. The Soyani pantheon... or I should say Pavar's pantheon, has been the metric against which I have measured all other fantasy pantheons.
Mm-hmm.
It hangs together so well. It's so well thought out.
It's quite good.
Yeah, actually, interestingly enough, Lawrence Schick, who went on to he's now doing work on the Elder Scrolls Online, if I understand correctly.
That's good to know.
Oh yeah, no. He's a long time ago in Dragon like 26 or something like that. He presented a complete and highly varied pantheon of gods. And what's kind of sad about it is that it's this lovely pantheon where he clearly had referred to Empire of the Petal Throne for how to describe the gods and, you know, their relative positions and, you know, their priesthoods and such like. And it's this really marvelous piece of work. And I only wish it had gotten turned into something more than probably in his own home campaign. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it just shows up in the Dragon magazine. And then, you know, like a lot of articles from the time, never gets picked up into anything, which is too bad.
Okay. But, he said in an awkward transition.
No, quite all right. So we have one last guy.
Who?
Zlame, you should do it, Scott, since you have such an interest.
You know, at various points in my life, I definitely have personally been a follower of Dlamelish, green-eyed, it says green eyes, but I think that's a typo, green-eyed lady of sins, mistress of demons, obsidian princess of the damned. Yeah. Flutter.
I'm going to make one slight adjustment to your pronunciation.
Yeah.
And that is, you've got that the last L attached a little bit more to the ISH than Professor Barker would have. He would say Dlamelish.
Ooh, that's better.
Dlamelish.
Yeah. I like that you have the source in your ear, because then you can pass it on to the world. There's only so much you can get out of the pronunciation guide.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I suspect that it probably varies. I mean, Professor Barker's immediate answer to that would have been, well, you know, it kind of varies from place to place, you know. But yes, there is a way to pronounce the name of the goddess, and there you go. And yes, here, I mean, each one of these gods, as presented in Empire of the Petal Throne, comes across in a very four color kind of depiction. And what is clear if you compare these descriptions to the ones that appear later in the Tekemel source book is that these are supposed to be evocative. But what they miss out on is that each and every one of these gods has a somewhat sophisticated, in fact, very sophisticated place in the pantheon. I mean, Lord Hui is wanting the universe to be constantly unfolding in change, going from one in chaos state to another. And Lord Vimukla, who is normally presented as being, you know, the god of flame, right? Burn, baby, burn. Lord Vimukla is the embodiment of, if change takes place, Lord Vimukla is that change. That the transition from matter to energy to matter is that moment is his. Okay? And similarly, Lady Dlamelish is going to want each and every change to be one that is experienced and to be enjoyed. Now, the simplistic way of looking at this is saying, oh, she's just about having fun and she's just a party girl.
No.
Uh-uh. And I think Bob Alberti put his finger on it in the story that he wrote for Lady Dlamelish's cohort, Lady Hrihael, when he writes this vignette that talks about how there was this worshiper of Lady Hrihael who was all about experience, that his entire life was around experiencing things, and to turn away from that was to actually betray the faith of the goddess. And there's a real, I think, theological moment to that, that believers are challenged to experience things and to find the pleasure in that experience, which to the outsider merely looks like, let's go have fun.
It's the genuine philosophical and theological depth to this fantasy pantheon that I think separates it from many others. Amongst other things, but that's one of the defining characteristics.
Thank you for listening to the Hall of Blue Illumination. You can email us your questions, queries, and other topics at citizen@techmlpodcast.com. You can also find TechML Podcast on Twitter and Facebook. Until next time, take care and have fun playing in the world of TechML.